I'm going to talk about the Anhigs, which was the idea introduced by John and David Pancato.
Nice to meet you.
And so I am bringing some wood to the forest. I'm sorry for that, but that was the subject I was working on recently, and I have a couple of new results I would like to present. I'll start a little bit with a little bit more motivations why it might be interesting to look at this idea. Then I introduce the Anhigs. Then I introduce the holographic version of the Anhigs, where the non-local action from the Anhigs is represented as a boundary effective action in a 5D local theory. A few phenomenological issues, mostly related to electric precision observables. So this is based on the paper of David and John, and my recent paper with Manolo Perez Victoria from Granada. If you're feeling uneasy that you missed this one, no, you didn't. It's just be available in the evening. So to start, so why do we believe that there is new physics? So from the experimental point of view, we have a lot of indications from cosmology, from the signals of dark matter. However, very few indications from collider physics. The one indication that was around for some time, -2, is probably bound to go away soon, so we have almost nothing. If you think why use new physics in the LHC ridge, there is even less indications for that. Of course, we have this theoretical argument, hierarchy problem, stabilizing the weak scale needs the weak scale physics. However, this is the theory, and theory might be wrong. Another argument is the coincidence between the thermal cross-section that you need to get the required dark matter abundance and the weak scale. We also had this also very recent indication from ATPP BETS that sees some peak in the electron spectrum that might be due to positron annihilation, to dark matter annihilation that produces excess positrons. But the rumor is that if you like this result, you shouldn't get involved too much into it, because it's also probably bound to go away soon. So if you want to make an opposite case, yes, for no new physics in the LHC ridge, of course, you have plenty of arguments. Electroweak precision observables, flavor physics, CP violation. So this all point, they show that there is no higher dimensional operators of some kind. Or if there are, these higher dimensional operators have to be suppressed by some high scale. So if new physics is around, it's very, very clever to avoid generating higher dimensional operators for this standard model, at least the ones that we can observe. So if you want to make the case for the Higgs, it's much better motivated. We haven't observed the Higgs, but there are good reasons to believe that particle Higgs boson is around. Yeah, and that's it's a simple idea. It does what it's supposed to be, breaks electric symmetry, and at the same time, it internalizes WW scattering. And the standard model can be extrapolated to high scales, and it's consistent. If the Higgs boson mass is light, it's consistent with precision tests. The problem is on the theoretical side, there is a hierarchy problem. On the experimental side, there is a small tension between this lower limit from lab and the electric fit, which points to smaller masses of the Higgs. So this is a 2 sigma discrepancy. So in fact, this discrepancy might be a bit more than it seems to be from these numbers. First, the leptonic data, it will know that they prefer a very light Higgs, even lighter than 70, around 30, 50 GeV. On the other hand, also another thing is if the tau data used to determine the QCD contributions to the vacuum polarization photon, then the electroweak, there is this paper of Italian group that points that if you prefer this tau data to electron data in order to improve the agreement of G minus 2 with experiment, then it also moves the fit of the electric fit of the Higgs mass towards smaller values, not by much, but by several, certainly by few GeV. So that might be the only tension of this experimental tension in this standard particle Higgs scenario. If you talk about alternatives, there's of course several ones, and each has its problems, and these problems come from the fact that we don't observe any experiment on any collider hints for new physics. So if new physics is within the LHC reach, it must be extremely stealthy. In a sense, it is very efficient in hiding itself from low energy experimenters. So recently, George proposed this scenario for very stealthy optics. So proposed the unparticles, which instead of particles, you have a continuum of new degrees of freedom. But as for today, it is unclear if the unparticles could address any nagging problems of the standard model. Even more recent is the proposal of David and John to make the Higgs also part of the unparticle sector. So in a way, you can think of it as you take the kinetic term of the Higgs, which is as the usual p squared local form, and you replace it with something that is non-local and non-analytic. So there is also I don't have a strong argument that this might help with any lagging problems of the standard model. However, it turns out to be a new consistent scenario of electric braking that is distinct in several ways. It's phenomenologically distinct from the usual particle Higgs. So if something like that is realized, maybe it clarifies the elusiveness of new physics. There's also a possibility that using this idea you can hide the Higgs from lab. So what I think about the un-Higgs is at this point it's on the same footing as other so-called unmotivated scenarios like Hidden Valley, for example, or quirks. You don't have a compelling theoretical reasons. However, it is a theoretically viable and phenomenologically distinctive scenario that deserves further study. So what is this scenario in some more detail? So what you can take the Higgs action, the momentum space, and instead of the usual kinetic term, you write the kinetic term in this non-local, non-analytic form. First, this power tells you that the Higgs propagator has a non-analytic dependence on momentum, and this form minus p squared plus mu squared will tell you that there is a mass gap, so the spectral function if you write the spectral function for this, it will be zero up to the scale mu, and then it will continuously grow above that scale. And of course, then you can also write down some mass parameters that are analogous to the Higgs mass in the quadratic action, and depending on this mass parameter, you can either have an isolated pole below that continuum or no isolated pole. So this action is non-local because if you transform it to the position space, you will have the following form in which this kinetic function will not be proportional to the delta function. So you have a kinetic term that connects the Higgs fields at different positions of space. So the propagator for the Higgs is just the is the inverse of that. Far below the mass gap, so if you're at the momenta much less than the scale mu, this looks like a rescaled normal particle propagator. However, once you reach this mass gap, it's completely different because it has already at tree level, it has an imaginary part. So it's as if it has a classical width. So instead of a pole in an S plane, you have a branch cut that starts for p squared larger than mu squared. So this action can be made gauge invariant by adapting the Mandelstam, the old prehistoric Mandelstam construction from 62. And this construction leads to a very peculiar set of interactions for the M-Higgs. So first of all, there are interactions with arbitrary high numbers of gauge fields. So know that the Higgs, for example, interacts with one Higgs interacts with two gauge fields. Here, when you go to the M-Higgs, you can have an arbitrary number of W bosons in the vertex. Then, also, the self interactions vertices are of the gauge bosons. First, they are modified. When the Higgs acquires a VEF, you also have five gauge boson vertices, 6K, and so on. So this looks like a completely crazy idea because you completely screw up the gauge structure of the standard model. However, there is a surprising fact that this construction still leads to unitary WW scattering. So you know how it works in the standard model. If you compute the WW scattering amplitude of longitudinal gauge bosons, you will find that it grows like energy squared. So this is a behavior that is not consistent with the it's high enough energies, it violates the unitarity bounds. However, in the standard model, there's another contribution to this process with the Higgs exchange that happens to contribute exactly at high energies, opposite of that, and the amplitude the total amplitude asymptotes to a constant. So now, when you go to the M-Higgs, you screw up this, and you still think that how this might cancel. The funny thing is that it still does cancel, and high energy behavior of a theory with the M-Higgs instead of a Higgs is still unitary.
What about something like WW to 3Ws or 4Ws or something like that?
This has not been computed, but I think I think it is still unitary. So the conclusion of David and John was that the M-Higgs can do what the standard model Higgs does. It can break electroweak symmetry, and it can unitarize WW scattering at the same time. So this is a consistent theory of electroweak breaking. One can ask the question, the Higgs has also another very important role in the standard model, so it contributes to electroweak precision of Herrmann. So I will come to that later in this talk. However, you might wonder if this Higgs contributions can be recovered in this M-Higgs theory, or what's the prediction of the M-Higgs when it comes to S and T parameter in this domain. So to summarize that part, so this is clearly a new direction.
Do you have an answer?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's
tell us, so, okay.
Yes. Okay. So This is clearly a new direction in model building, but it leaves this approach leaves, in my opinion, several issues unclear. First, there is the issue of gauge invariance, and you probably know there was a debate about how unique is the procedure of rendering this action gauge invariant. So I think that is this finally solved? Because I saw a long list of papers that are claiming very different things. However, so that's a question you may ask about. Then, when you have your propagator picks up an imaginary part, it signals some new degrees of freedom. So, can you identify these new degrees of freedom? What is the cutoff of the theory? That's also, I think, is unclear. Yeah, in the approach that you are pursuing, what is the amount of fine tuning? I suggest to try another approach to the Ampliques, which is gives the same low energy effective action. However, all these questions can be unambiguously addressed. So the approach is what I call holographic Ampliques. So the Ampliques starts with a non-local action for the Ampliques. However, a non-local action, this is something that usually that can arise in a higher dimensional theory. So if you write down the effective action of a higher dimensional theory, you can get a non-local action. So I will explain in a moment how you do that. The advantage of starting with a local gauge theory in 5D is there are many. So when you start with a well-understood local physics, you just use the usual method of QFT. So consistency comes almost for free. Gauge invariance comes for free because you just use the usual prescription. You turn derivatives into covariant derivatives.
Sorry, comment on that. I thought your issue last time was the uniqueness of making the gauge, the action gauge invariant, not whether or not the procedure John and David used did make the action gauge invariant. Getting gauge invariance for free is quite a different statement for saying saying this is the unambiguous way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can somehow trace what is the ambiguity about. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So that's the you can also the starting point is unambiguous. Yeah? Here, when you go into a low energy effective action, depending on the dynamics of your theory, you might get a different set of interaction vertices. Then I also argue you can make a very clean computation, so somehow recovering the result that why the WW scattering amplitude happens to be unitary, and also the computation of electric precision observables is surprisingly easy in this setup. And another thing is that there is a wider spectrum of phenomenological possibilities. So in that construction of David and John, you have just the only new degrees of freedom are those of the Ampliques. However, if you start with some microscopic theory and get this as an effective description of this microscopic theory, some strongly coupled theory, then you expect usually some more complicated phenomena, more particles, for example, vector particles or globals or anything like that. So this 5D approach is somehow allows you to describe this more general possibilities. Okay, so technically, how do you do it? So first, let me just go back a few steps, and how do you break electroweak symmetry in 5D? So here what I present is this approach of Agasha et al., where the gauge group in the bulk has custodial symmetry, so instead of SU2 cross U1, you have SU2 cross U2. And this is something you need to do if you want to have a large scale here in the UV, and if you still want to keep the corrections with the T parameter at bay. So what you do is very, very natural. So you start with some warped metric, you have this extended electric symmetry in the bulk. You can break this symmetry by boundary conditions to the standard model gauge symmetry on the UV break. And then if you want to break electric symmetry, you just introduce a scalar field in the bulk, or it can be localized on the infrared brain, as is often done, and this will break you in the bulk. It will break the left cross right group down to the diagonal group, and in the low energy theory, this amounts to breaking SU2 left cross U1 down to U1 electromagnetic. Now, how can you generalize this setup to describe the electric braking by the anhic? So the intermediate step is the so-called soft wall electric braking. For soft walls were introduced first in the context of ADS-QCD, and the idea is to remove the infrared brain completely from the theory. You think that if you do that, you will not get the mask up, but for example, in ADS, you need this infrared brain in order to have your first KK modes are parametrically separated from the standard model degrees of freedom. However, if you modify this metric in infrared, it's not ADS but something more general, this is a perfectly viable possibility not to have infrared break. And this was introduced in ADS QCD because it was discovered that this kind of backgrounds, this kind of construction, better describes certain properties of the meson spectrum. So you can do the same in the context of electric breaking. And so there is no infrared brain, but the work factor is not in far infrared, departs from ADS. How do you know what would be the spectrum of this theory? The thing you do, okay, so this is a, so to find the spectrum, you have to solve the equation of motion in this fiber. So this equation of motion depends on the work factor, and this Higgs can have some mass there. You have to solve it, impose the boundary conditions, and you find the spectrum. But the nice way to visualize what the kind of spectrum you obtain is to turn this equation into a kind of Schrödinger equation. So what you do, you just rescale your Higgs field, and then you get rid of the first derivative, and what you get, it looks like a Schrödinger equation with some potential. This potential depends on how the warp factor varies, and also depends on the mass step. But so now, you see, this depends on the second derivative first derivative of the warp factor squared. So you can easily convince yourself that this potential will go to infinity in the infrared, which in a sense mimics the hard wall of infrared brain, if this warp factor decays exponentially in infrared with this power larger than 1. So in that case, if you have this very fast decay of warp factor infrared, the potential, so here you have a UV brain, and this acts as an infinite wall, and then you will have a potential that has some form that goes to infinity, and then you see that you have just a bunch of discrete bound state in that potential. On the other hand, if this warp factor doesn't decay fast enough, what will happen is that this will go to zero in infrared. And then you don't have a mass gap, you just have a continuum of modes. So of course, you see that there is some intermediate case, alpha equals 1, in which case the potential asymptotes to a constant which is larger than 0. So then there will be a continuum of modes separated from 0 by a mass gap, and the mass gap depends on how fast this warp factor decays. So that brings me to 5D realization of the anthics. Yeah. So what you have to do, you have to write down a model in which Higgs propagate in a 5D spacetime. And the metric has asymptotically goes to zero in infrared with goes to zero exponential. And this coefficient will be identified with the mask. And of course, this is only, you need this behavior asymptotic infrared, but you can multiply this by any power, any polynomial of Z. And for example, you can choose this kind of metric, which is ADS metric in ultraviolet, and is exponentially cut off in infrared. And this will be also be an unparticle type metric, an unparticle with a mass gap. So how you realize it is very easy. You just write the electric theory in the bulb, and you assume that the, your metric behaves like that. Now, now there is, of course, I can ask the question, how does how you get such a metric as a solution to some Einstein equation of motion? For the moment, for the sake of this talk, I will brush this question under the carpet. Yes? So, although this is, of course, a legitimate question you can ask, once you know how this, how such a background can be generated, you might think of identifying the ADS-CFT dual of that. This is not an easy task yet, but there are some ideas how ADS-CFT dual of that scenario can be identified. But for the time being, I'm just considering non-gravitational 5D theory in some fixed background. Now, another technical issue is how you deal with a 5D theory in which there is no well-defined KK modes. But usually what you do when you compute the amplitudes, you have exchange of KK modes, and you just sum over. Now you don't have KK modes, you don't have any normalizable modes, you just have a continuum. However, there is a an equivalent technique to deal with 5D theories. You just define a propagator that is defined in 4D momentum space, but 5D position space. So, for example, you have some states living on the boundary of 5D space, then, and you have this propagator that goes from the boundary to boundary, and you can compute the amplitudes, and this effectively sums the exchange of all the entire tower of KK modes. So, what you do here is you solve the equation of motion, and you have two solutions of that, two independent solutions. You define these two solutions appropriately. So I define one solution that it is regular in infrared, so it decays instead of blowing up. And the other solution, which is not regular, but I will just define it, that it vanishes on the ultraviolet break. And once you know these two solutions, you can write down the propagator in the mixed 4D momentum, 5D position space, and here is the explicit form. So if you know this two solutions in the equation of motion, you know the propagator. One maybe thing that will appear in a moment. So this propagator, the poles, usually this propagator, when you have a theory with a discrete set of modes, propagator will have a pulse, and these poles are encoded in this object that I called kinetic function. And then the way you find the kinetic function is that you, having this solution, you have to impose the boundary conditions, and from the so imposing that this propagator satisfies the appropriate boundary conditions on the UV brain, you will find the explicit expression for this kinetic function. It's just a derivative of the regular solution. That's eventual to raise some mass terms if you have some mass terms on the U. So, what is there to remember is basically that if you can solve the equation of motion, you know the propagator and you know the kinetic function, so you know the pole structure of the spectrum. Now, what happens when you this method is perfectly can be very easily adapted to unparticles. Again, solve the just the equation of motion. The difference will be that this, instead of a set of zeros, discrete zeros, will have just develop an imaginary part above some mask. No. Okay, so once you have this propagator, what you can write down, you can write down the effective action for the Higgs field living, for the 5D Higgs field. You can write the four-dimensional effective action. And again, the usually what is done when you write down the effective action is you integrate out the KK modes. There is another way which is much more convenient for in practice. You know, instead of integrating the KK modes, so the mass eigenstates, you can integrate out the states that from the bulk. That would be a combination of massless and massive eigenstate. That's perfectly viable procedure and also very easily adaptable here. So you define your low energy variable as a boundary. So you have a five-dimensional Higgs field that depends on for the momenta and the position, and the boundary value of this Higgs field is your low energy variable. So then, since your low energy variable is a boundary field, I mean the boundary value of the field. So its propagator is the propagator from the boundary to the boundary. So the kinetic term in the effective action is the inverse of this propagator from the boundary to boundary. So I just take this propagator and I write down the boundary to boundary propagator, and somehow I define this solution such that this part is zero at the boundary and this solution is one at the boundary. So this kinetic function is, so the boundary to boundary effective propagator is just this kinetic functions that I know how to compute once I solve the equation of motion. So this is the same kinetic function that enters here in the effective action. So one more thing one can add. So if you want to write down the fermions, yeah, there's what you could do. You have to put somewhere the standard model fermions in this theory. What is often done in the RS models is you put fermions in the bulk, which allows you to explain the large hierarchies in the Yukawa math matrix from wave function overlap in the bulk. What I do for the sake of this talk, I don't care about the hierarchy, the fermion mass hierarchies. I will just put all the fermions on the UV brain, all of them, including the top quark. So what you have is the this boundary fermions can have a Yukawa interaction with the Higgs field in the bulk, and once the Higgs field in the bulk gets the vacuum expectation value, it will just give the mass to the fermions, and then you will have an interaction of the Higgs field with two fermions. It's almost like in the standard model, only that this boundary value of the Higgs web doesn't have to be the Higgs web as we know it, 246 GeV. It's not related, so the Yukawa coupling doesn't have to be MF over V like in the standard model. It can take a bit different values. Okay. So what once we choose the warp factor, we just have to solve the equation of motion. So if you choose the simplest possible Bohr factor, the simplest possible that shows the unparticle plus mass gap behavior, then the equation of motion can be solved in terms of this exponential functions, and then using this master formula for the kinetic function, you'll get something like that. So this is the kinetic function that has a square root type non-locality, and it develops a mass gap for p squared. So this is the simplest possibility, but for reasons that we feel more familiar with ADS, in which case you can make the effective theory, I mean the 5D theory, valid at larger scales than just a
flat theory.
So what is better, what is easier to do, what one can do in order to have a ADS space near the UV boundary is to consider this type of work factor. So again, you have this exponential that gives you the unparticle continuum plus mass gap, and you multiply it with 1 over. So again, you can solve the equation of motion, and the solution is some kind of hypergeometric functions. Compute the kinetic function, and then expand these solutions at small energies and small momenta where this is ADS curvature. I mean, this is inverse ADS curvature. So for momenta smaller than the ADS curvature, the kinetic function takes this form, and this is very similar to the form considered by David and John, only that there is some momentum-dependent factor multiplying this mu squared minus p squared. So, and you see that the exponent here, that defines your non-local behavior, is related to the mass term in the of the Higgs in the fifth dimension. So what I was really considering is a very simple modification of that theory. So because I don't like hypergeometric functions because they are more difficult to deal with in Mathematica, you can crank up the mass term a little bit, and then you get, instead of hypergeometric functions, you get the Bessel functions, which everybody knows by heart. And in that case, the kinetic function is some combination of the Bessel functions. Again, if you go to momenta smaller than the curvature scale, you recover this kind of un-Higgs action. But now, I just chose this. I tuned this Fitti theory in order to exactly recover David and John's action, un-Higgs action, at low energy, at small momenta. So that model you can represent in five-dimensional, exactly that model, with some type of the five-dimensional background. However, the difference is that this form is valid. This is the more general form. This form is valid below some scale that is defined by the inverse or by the ADS curvature or inverse ADS length. So we have a scale 1 over r that is works as a cutoff to the un-Higgs scenario. So the below that scale we have this un-Higgs action. Above that scale we have 5D theory. So it's you have some UV completion of the un-Higgs. Another thing. I told you that this exponent here is related to the mass term, and this mu can be any real number larger than zero. So this is well defined for any real positive mu. For example, now you can see that the relation between this parameter mu and the unparticle dimension in the un-Higgs action is this. So you can, for one funny thing is that you can also take d equals 2 in that case, which corresponds to mu equals 0, and you get a well-defined action. So somehow this way you can define the continuation of the unparticle dimension to d equals 2. In that case, the original unparticle action would be would the kinetic term would just vanish. So here, instead of 0 of power, you get some logarithm. So you see that this cannot be defined without the cutoff, but apart from that, it's a perfectly well-defined model. So on the other hand, if you take mu that would correspond naively to the dimension smaller than 1, you will not. This will also be a consistent action. However, it doesn't correspond to an particle with dimension smaller than one. Of course, it cannot, because that would be that would violate unitarity. Then, in that case, the leading term here is just the usual particle term. So, the case mu larger than one is, for all practical purpose, equal to the case mu equals one, to the which corresponds to dimension one, which is just normal particle dimension.
Right. What happens? What happens between two and one?
Between two and one of what?
For little d.
Between the two and one, that's basically where you. This is the. This parameter mu is between zero and one, yeah? And that's the unparticle. So.
Sorry, d. I thought d equals one is the free thing. D equals two is the thing that normally doesn't make sense.
Uh-huh.
And I thought d bigger than two is the thing that normally makes sense.
No. D, d equals 1 is particle. Yeah?
Yes.
If d equals, if d is bigger than 2, it doesn't make sense because...
D bigger, sorry, that's right, d bigger than 2. So,
huh?
Yes, I'm sorry, so my question is, what happens, so d bigger than 2, this still doesn't make sense?
No, because d bigger than 2 would be negative, yeah? But you see that the mass term I defined as mu squared. There is no such thing here. You can do this. There is a because
so negative mass squared. Does that mean that there's some profile?
No,
now?
You see, if you have the Brayton-Allen-Friedman bound, because you have you're in ideas asymptotically.
Right.
So mu equals zero is the smallest possible value of the mass term. Of course, this is not very rigorous because it's not exactly the that mass term.
It's not obvious since it's mu squared that enters there.
No, no. But the point is that you know in ADS. You can write a negative mass term, huh? But the mass term there is a bound on this mass term.
But what are you referring to as the mass term here? Your m hat squared of z.
Yeah. Forget
so
about
I
this so because
I don't see
this
a difference between negative and positive mu. Just looking at that.
No, there is no difference, of course. So
yeah.
It means that it doesn't make sense to to take mu smaller than zero in that formula. I mean, by definition, mu is bigger than zero, because negative mu corresponds to the same, is the same theory as positive mu.
Oh, okay, that I accept. Yeah, okay, so you're not getting anything new by going to negative.
No, no, but I get just exactly the same, you know,
yeah,
whatever
okay,
I already got.
Okay,
so,
that,
means, okay, this, so this is
I
something
understand.
I made. Yeah, I
except the Bessel functions do change.
Yeah, but of course, but I say here already by definition, mu is bigger. Oh, you can think that it's the absolute sign here, which I omitted.
Well, that's part of the question. I mean, does it really not make sense that mu is negative?
No.
Well, you just choose the other Bessel function then. Right? You just choose the Bessel function, whether it's which argument is based on the boundary conditions you want to impose.
You just replace mu by an absolute value on mu on the
right
hand side.
Right.
Itself.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
You can ask a different question if this makes sense, you know. But to mu have it imaginary, and the answer is no, yeah.
That I certainly
and
accept.
This is
yeah
something that would correspond going farther, but of course it's coming. Yeah. So if mu were imaginary, this would be times something, the mass would be more than minus 4, it would violate the Brayton-Allen-Friedman bound, and you would get some action which is probably sick, but I don't know exactly what is the sickness here. Okay, so now a short comment. I started with a 5D theory, so I have all sorts of, I don't have only Higgs in the bulk. I also have to gauge fields in the bulk. I have to have it because, by definition, Higgs is the charge on the electroid group. So, electroid group has to propagate in the bulk. That it means that there are Kaluza-Klein excitations of the vector of the gauge bosons, nonmodular gauge bosons, and also because I have a Higgs, it will have some physical scalars in it. So I also have it, and I can compute the spectra of this by. Again, they have some effective potential, which depends on the warp factor. This pseudoscalar also depends on the effective metric that is somehow related to the warp factor and the VEF. But anyway, the bottom line is that the mass gap for these resonances is typically the same as for the un-Higgs. In fact, in the simplest case, the vector resonances, the mass gap is 1/3 that of the un-Higgs. So what you expect, if you get some microscopic theory, write it dual, you would expect that un-Higgs will not come alone. There will be all sorts of other phenomena that will accompany it.
Isn't that bad? Phenomenology?
Yes. Depends. It's not studied. I don't know. Nobody
well,
studied.
What's the mass of your Higgs? 120, 130, 200?
No, but for example, you could imagine the situation that you have a... Okay, even I pointed it here. These vectors can take over the role of unitarizing WW scattering. This is just like in the Higgsless models. So what you get there, you get an un-Higgs version of the Higgsless models, which
sure.
is un-Higgsless. But
worried about it being ruled out.
Yeah,
worried about it being ruled out.
Yeah, being ruled out. So
it's a third of the mass of the Higgs. Your Higgs is, you know.
No, it's a mass gap of the Higgs. Yeah, okay.
So if your mass of your Higgs is at a TeV,
so you think that you could see experimentally in the Tevatron a 300 GeV continuum of vector resonances? I'm not sure.
And that's putting the Higgs as...
And in that case, because Higgs is not important here, yeah, because they unitarize WW scattering, this mass gap could be one TeV.
Yeah. I mean, the usual problem is that we see the W excitations unless they're heavy.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
As you say, it may be a little bit different if there's a continuum of
uh-huh. so this is
W
so
masses
so this
uh-huh. of excitation masses.
Yeah, but I don't mean that they, of course, they we cannot have a continuum of W's below 100 GeV, let's say. But I don't know exactly what is the bound on that. This is a scenario that is completely unstudied.
Right.
Yeah, so
I mean, partly you want to get good precision electric weep, which means that presumably...
Which is again not computed here.
You should be reasonably small. Is that right?
Probably.
And yet you don't want to see these W resonances, mm-hmm. or not, I keep saying W, well, I guess they are W resonances.
This is W continua, yes,
W.
This is like a very,
yeah.
you can think of a very dense set of W
and
resonances.
Yet you don't want to see those guys, so that means your mass scale has to be pushed up, so the question
mm-hmm.
is whether you can...
Mm-hmm. So this is, of course, the same problem as in the Higgsless scenario.
Right, exactly.
However,
yeah.
this is, as I said, this is not explored, so I cannot give you
yeah.
any conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
There will be both electric precision observables will be unaffected, and also the bounds from CDF, I guess, they will be affected.
Are they all in particles? Do you have any freedom to...
Well, of course you can, for example, have fermions in the bulk and then have KK fermions, yeah? So
I would think
right
that...
Whether you have a particle depends on the potential, right? On the potential behavior in the particle.
Yes.
I mean, do they all have the same behavior?
Yeah, I kind of again. If you use this this kind of metrics, it's always the same behavior. That is potential, although they have different formulae,
mm-hmm.
they just go down
mm-hmm.
and end up at some mass gap
mm-hmm.
above zero. So
yeah,
there is
no
bound states in this potential. If you have.
I would think that you have a lot of freedom. I mean, we could have replaced this soft wall by just some hard wall that divides ADS into two pieces, and you would have, say, your Higgs propagating on the infrared side of that wall to make it into one of these things. So that instead of the soft wall, it would just sort of immediately make a transition between ADS and the un-Higgs type thing. But then you actually have the freedom of how you whether you want the gauge bosons to propagate in that other half of the wall. So I think that's the kind of thing that you're asking about. Is you could have various possibilities where how the gauge bosons, whether they are in fact unparticles, or they could see a different metric if there are other fields in the bulk.
Yeah.
Seems
if
like
you really
time
the wall is something coming from somewhere from the sphere on top of different.
Yeah, you're not explaining that warp factor. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the as long as I don't explain the warp, I think if I like started in some string model, I would be pushed to some warp factor and I could tell you what are the predictions. Yeah, at this level, there is many phenomenological possibilities.
I have another question. If suppose I go to a limit that looks like the standard unparticle model, which is your choice here.
I will go to
do
that.
Do you necessarily then have these W excitations?
Yeah, so that's the next thing I wanted to say. So So the predictions is that naturally you would get all sorts of all sorts of zoology here. Yeah. However, you can consistently decouple all of it. Yeah. You can choose the metric in such a way. In fact, what I'm doing, yeah, which is that I put the vectors in a different metric than the Higgs. That's the simplest thing to do. And since I'm not working on gravitational theory, I don't get it as a solution. This is a perfectly allowed thing to do. So in a more fundamental theory, you would imagine that the kinetic term of the vectors is multiplied by some Dilaton profile, so that effectively the metric is changed. Yeah, and this is. But of course, again, if you start with a string model, you know what is this, yeah, and you cannot do these things. However, at this level, I can consistently parametrically decouple and just have a un-Higgs theory. So this is the same theory. This another description of the theory that John and David worked on, and I can continue. And that's what I'm gonna do here. So. And the reason is that this is much simpler, and although I'm brushing interesting things under the carpet, I can get to the conclusion. Okay, so
I'm interested in that statement about pseudoscalars. You say you can also decouple the pseudoscalars?
Uh-huh.
Or
yeah. So imagine.
So how are you doing that again?
In fact, getting the spectrum of those is a bit complicated. Yeah, but if I put the vectors in a different metric. Because they mix
about
with
the vectors. I'm just interested in the
pseudo. But however, the pseudoscalars they are mixtures of the degrees of freedom living in the Higgs and in the fifth component of the vectors. Because you know you have this A5 here, yeah, and it's also a scalar. And then there's also you have these pseudoscalars from the Higgs, yeah, if you like in the usual Higgs is G's.
Mm-hmm.
And the one combination of that is eaten by the massive vector fields on my massive continuum, and the other combination is physical.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all very intricate here. However, changing the metric here also affects the pseudoscalars.
So if you do decouple the W bosons, is there a definite answer for the pseudoscalars?
Yeah, they also decoupled.
So they also decoupled.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Even though I might have said in my mind that, you know, an un-Higgs spectrum corresponds to, you know, more than one Higgs, but you say that all of them are eaten up in giving the W's,
mm-hmm.
the W excitations, the
yes.
masses, and there's no leftover light pseudoscalar degree of freedom. That's what
yeah,
you,
I, yeah, okay. Okay.
It's like Randall Sundgren, but they'll
mm-hmm.
get eaten.
Okay.
Okay. So now I don't have. Yeah, I was a bit. Slow, but yeah, I want to say one more important thing, a few more important things. But so I have all this, I have played with all this holographic formulation, and the main reason is that it makes the computations easy. So, you know, in John's paper, yeah, the computing amplitude is a nightmare because you have to find the vertex, yeah, to really struggle hard.
Yeah, have a graduate student.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I don't have a graduate student, so I had to cook up a little bit something easier. And this is extremely easy what you do here. So what happens? So it's not very very well visible. If you compute some process which is like WW scattering with an un-Higgs exchange. So what happens here? Yeah, you start with W's. They can interact at anywhere in the bulk with the Higgs because they are bulk fields. Yeah, and then the interaction can happen anywhere in the bulk. Then go from anywhere in the bulk to anywhere in the bulk, but this is anywhere prime, you know? And then again interacts via the vertex. The vertex is here is written for the one Higgs and two gauge bosons. It depends on the, as usual for the Higgs, on the VEF, but on the local VEF in this dimension, and also on the work factor. So what I have to do, so in the standard model, I would just write this vertex, which would be G squared V over 4. And propagate the Higgs. In the un-Higgs, I put this vertex, which is position dependent. I propagate it with the position dependent propagator, and then I put again the vertex. So this is what I get. If I want to compute this amplitude, what I have, instead of a propagator, Higgs propagator, I have an effective propagator. So it consists of this 5D position propagator and this 5D vertices. And then I have to integrate out over all anywhere and anywhere prime, and this is how I define my propagator. And the normalization is such that, so if this was a Higgs, it would be just a V squared times the Higgs propagator. What I want to do is to define it such that the un-Higgs amplitude is the same as the Higgs amplitude with the Higgs propagator exchanged by effective propagator. So, yeah, so in that case it's easy. So when I have any Sanamon amplitude, I exchange the propagator with the effective propagator. That's the rule. In fact, because Higgs interacts differently with fermions on the UV brain, in fact, the effective propagator will depend whether we compute the process with the gauge boson or with fermions. So, for example, if you have two fermions, they both live on the UV brain, so this is just a brain-to-brain propagator, and there's no integration over the bulk. If we are computing, for example, top scattering into longitudinal gauge bosons, we'll have a propagator from the bulk to anywhere in the bulk, and then we integrate. So then, we have to define three different kinds of effective propagators. This has fermion-fermion has no integration at all. Gauge fermion has one integration, and the gauge has two integrations. So the funny thing is that if I take this model that exactly reproduces David and John model, then I can do these integrals. So I integrals of Bessel functions, and Bessel functions are integrable, especially if you have Mathematica. And you can have a very simple formulae for this propagator. So this propagator is basically just the inverse of the kinetic function, and the kinetic function was this, plus some mass parameter. But others are given by a bit more complicated expressions, but only a bit more complicated expressions. So you see that the poles are still where there are zeros of the kinetic function, or in that case, in the case of the un-Higgs, this is a branch cut instead of the poles. However, there is, this should be S squared, I forgot to change it. So this effective propagator, so the important thing that you can see from this is that when you have gauge and gauge fermion propagator, when you go to large S, such that this becomes larger than this mass parameter, this gauge propagator, this will be 1 over S squared, because this cancels with this, if this is large. So the leading behavior is 1 over S, just like the Higgs propagator. The same for the gauge fermion propagator. If this is larger than this, then cancels with this, and the Higgs effective un-Higgs propagator between gauge and fermion states is just asymptotically 1 over S. Just like the Higgs propagator. So the conclusion is that the UV properties of the un-Higgs are exactly the same as the UV properties of the Higgs. So any UV question in the standard model has exactly the same answer in the un-Higgs scenario. And that was what is maybe in a more intricate way what John and David discovered, yeah, that the WW scattering is unitary in UV. Because the propagators in UV are the same. So here I drew, this is the Higgs propagator, or equivalently the propagator for D equals 1. If you go to D equals 2, in my definition of D equals 2, the propagator, the Euclidean propagator, has the same asymptotics and is slightly different in the infrared region.
Well, of course, there is a detailed question as whether that difference creates a problem. Since WW scattering has a unitary problem by 1 TeV,
mm-hmm.
right? Does this
finite
discrepancy
create
a problem or not by 1 TeV?
No. Well, it's not the discrepancy, but the asymptotic value is the same as in the standard model.
Well, I understand, but
okay,
it could temporarily violate unitarity at 1 TeV.
But of course, there are large portions of parameter space. In fact, this is generic parameter space where it doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
David made a plot. Why did you do that?
Okay.
So maybe this is the answer for the WW scatterings, and I want to go to electroweak precision observables in my last minus 1 minute. Yeah. So in the standard model, this is the expression for T. in terms of the integral with the Higgs propagator and some other factors. And you know that this this Higgs contribution to T and S is logarithmically divergent in the standard model, but this divergence is cancelled by the gauge bosons, by the loops of gauge bosons. So the final answer for the operator is finite. But what is very convenient to define is the delta T is the difference between the standard model contribution with some Higgs mass, with respect to some reference mass, which is usually taken to be 100 GeV or 115 GeV. And this is a finite quantity, which depends for large Higgs masses, depends logarithmically on the Higgs mass. So the delta T is a difference, for example, with respect to 100 GeV. And then you know this plot very well. If you go with the Higgs mass toward larger values, you start, by definition, you start with delta S, delta T equals zero here for 100 GeV Higgs. However, if you increase mass, you logarithmically go away from the ellipse. So somehow you almost choose the, you could have any short escape path from the ellipse, but you choose one of them. So from this plot, the conclusion is that the Higgs mass must be around 100 GeV. So for example, recent GFITER gives the number, the upper bound of the 2 sigma confidence level is 145. What happens with the un-Higgs? So I told you, what you have to do, you have to replace the Higgs propagator with the effective un-Higgs propagator. Since this effective propagator has the same UV properties, this diagram is still log divergent in momentum, when you do the integration of the momentum. So you can again just define delta T and delta L in the same way as before, just the contribution of the un-Higgs minus the contribution of the Higgs with some reference mass, which I take to be 100. What happens there? So this is the very nice picture of bits on the string. Let's take this. This corresponds to, it's not very well visible, mu equals 1, which is d equals 1, which is basically the standard model case. The solid line is I vary the Higgs mass, the usual Higgs mass, just for comparison, from 50 GeV to 1000 GeV. And here, I vary the Higgs, un-Higgs mass, the red dots are when I vary the un-Higgs mass parameter from 50 GeV to... Here there is no difference because I chose the particle case, mu equals 1 and d equals 1, so this is just like the Higgs, this is just a consistency test. Now I go to a different case, for example, mu equals 0, which is my definition of d equals 2. So when I start with a Higgs mass parameter 50 GeV, I get more or less the Higgs contribution. There is slight shift here. However, I can change this mass parameter very large, up to 1000 the GeV, and then I still get more or less the Higgs, the contribution of 100 GeV Higgs. This is because I chose the mass gap 50 GeV here. So even if I choose the mass parameter of the Higgs very large, the point that the continuum...
What is the mass parameter?
Okay.
I can't remember.
So the mass parameter was just a mass parameter. We have the quadratic action, and I have the mass parameter in the Lagrange. The mass gap is this p squared minus mu squared to some power, which tells you when this action becomes imaginary.
So your continuum starts at mu, is that right?
Yes. So here a continuum starts very low, and even though this mass parameter can be very large, the Higgs just mimics the light Higgs. The continuum, for the sake of electric precision observables, can mimic the light Higgs.
So is there an isolated pole in that case, or is the pole buried in the continuum?
Okay. So in that case, it depends on this this mass parameter, which I vary here. Yeah. In this point, there would be a pole below.
Right, but at the
still,
higher ones, yeah.
I think for this point, there is no pole. There is just a pole hidden in the continuum.
Enhancement in the continuum. Okay.
So there are different cases. So the funny thing that a bit more of these plots that you can find in the paper. Here, what I vary is the Higgs dimension. So for example, here, I'm starting with dimension equals 1, and then my un-Higgs mass parameter was 100, and then it's basically the same as the Higgs at 100. Now, if I go with dimension towards 2, I get slightly negative contribution to S and slightly positive contribution to T. But still, I'm safely within the ellipse. Yeah? So this is now, this is the 50 GeV Higgs, and this is 200 GeV Higgs. So it doesn't depend much on this D here, but I'm still... On the other hand, yeah. So, yeah, so there are this, I plotted various slices of the Anti-Higgs parameter space in my recent paper, and the conclusion is that the Anti-Higgs is consistent with like constraints on SFT in a large portion of the parameter space. In particular, electric precession observables do not exclude conformal dimension D equals 2, or my definition, or you can have D very close to 2, or you can have a mass gap even below 100 GeV, and from the point of view of electric precession observables, it's okay. The next conclusion is that typically the Anti-Higgs mimics the standard model Higgs in a sense that its contributions are very similar to the Higgs contributions for some Higgs mass. Yeah? So this is maybe not that surprising, because the same you just modify one propagator, which enters also T and S. Yeah? So that the changes are correlated. But well, you have no theorem that it has to be on the line. You can see, for example, in this case that the Anti-Higgs points are slightly off the Higgs line. But however, from the point of view of electric precision observables, Anti-Higgs always looks like Higgs with some mass, even if its spectral function is of that type instead of a pole, it looks like a Higgs. Yeah, last one. If the another thing that you can see if you look at this plot long enough is that if the Anti-Higgs parameter is much smaller than the mass gap, then the Anti-Higgs mimics the standard model Higgs with the Higgs mass of the same order as this Anti-Higgs mass parameter. If, on the other hand, this is the case. This case, MUH smaller than the mass gap, is the case of the isolated pole, and it's not surprising. If this MUH is bigger than mu, which is this case without an isolated pole, just a continuum, the Anti-Higgs mimics the standard model Higgs with the mass more or less of the order of the mass gap. So that's the conclusions from the more recent paper. Just to summarize, so this is a new direction electric symmetry breaking beyond the standard model. It's consistent with unitarity of WW scattering and electric precision observables. The Anti-Higgs is visible to electric precision tests, but it's invisible to colliders. Yes, because effectively, it's like a particle with a large width. Yeah, so a realization of a stealthy Higgs, there was such models in the 80s. And even Lepp did some analysis of the bounds on that case. Yeah? This is not exactly the invisible Higgs, because it has a large width, which I think makes the case for experimenters much more difficult.
So there was the work by Espinosa and myself on that, and also Van der Beek, right?
Yeah, I know only Van der Beek, but...
Well, Espinosa and I all looked at what we call the worst case scenario, where Higgs was just spread out into arbitrary modes and so forth. So,
I look at it too. there are open questions. Yeah, what can be any use of that? Yeah, from the theoretical point of view, can you make some theoretical prejudice? Yeah, that this is something that you should expect. Can this be a part of a more symmetric scheme with a pseudo-Goldstone boson or supersymmetry? Supersymmetry would be cool, because then you can, instead of unparticles, you have some particles. but yeah, to conclude optimistically, so if Anti-Higgs is out there, CERN has a wrong machine. Yeah? So. Thank you.
Any more questions?
Well, I'll just make my usual comment. If this kind of scenario is right, you have to build the linear collider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Well,
Espinosa and I showed was that no matter what spectrum of spread out reduced, the ILC would be able to measure in windows in excess in the
that's
production mode. You know, it's a quantitative question as to how much luminosity you need to do that. it would need about 300 inverse depth of our at the ILC.
So I think also ILC can measure WW scattering, and that's another way to see that there is
some... Yeah, well, here I'm talking about a low energy ILC, so if you just look for the recoil spectrum against the Z and you have, say, a 500 GeV machine, then you can still do it if you've got enough luminosity to see that excess. No matter what the mode is.
However, if you measure WW scattering, you can see whatever the model is. Yeah, you can see if there is something that kicks in, that enters this amplitude and cuts off the linear growth. Yeah,
well,
so
there's a, of course, you know, many of us have looked at WW scattering and asked ourselves what it would take to determine whether or not WW scattering was or wasn't perturbative at one TeV, which is the question one wants to ask. It's very hard. It may require the SLHC, and there's been a recent detailed study, I forget by who, on it's called anatomy of WW scattering, but basically the same conclusions that you may need the SLHC to really make this determination. Even after 300 inverse femtobarns at the LHC, it's going to be tough.
Yeah, this I'm aware of. Yeah, but how many ILC you can easily...
ILC is straightforward, 500 GeV machine.
The only problem is that if LHC says nothing, then they won't build ILC, yeah? Which is probably the thing they should do, but politically it's impossible. On the other hand, if LHC discovers new physics, then it means that it can be probed at the LHC. So
it'd be a very unfortunate scenario. Unless supersymmetry or something like that comes with this, right? If you're, I still don't, there's still the issue of the hierarchy problem here, right? And
yes, I didn't comment on it.
The model in general doesn't cure that, right?
Yes, I forgot to put this comment. Yes, I don't address the hierarchy problem yet. It has this model still has it, just like the standard model, it has a hierarchy problem. However, you can try to embed it in a more symmetric scenario.
But it's less divergent than the standard.
What do you mean less divergent?
Just from dimensional analysis. The mass term for if the Higgs scaling dimension is bigger than 1, the mass term has a dimension bigger than 2, so it can't be a quadratic divergence. It's a smaller power. As you get closer to 2, the divergence goes away.
Yeah, but I know I don't agree with that, and we have to discuss it afterwards. Yeah. I thought I agree about the mass term, but if you want to generate the Higgs BEV,
the tuning of the BEV,
you still get this fine tuning, at least in that approach that I'm pursuing.
Yeah, I mean there are really these two kinds of fine tuning: quadratic fine tuning and the BEV fine tuning. So you're saying. I guess John is saying that the quadratic is ameliorated.
Yeah, because basically,
but not necessarily. The
you can see I can make this parameter very, very large, this un-Higgs mass parameter, and it's still the theory, the unitarity doesn't care about it because it sees the continuum and it's happy.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need this mass to be small. So we can however, the problem is if I want to solve the equation of motion to find a VEF at the weak scale. I mean, I have this scale here, yeah, which is 1/ curvature scale. And if I want to make this BEV parameter smaller than the curvature scale, I need fine tuning.
So
that's
does this get worse as you increase the Higgs mass, this fine tuning, or is it more or less independent of that?
More or less independent. You have some contributions that you have to balance. Yeah. From there. The point is that this VEF gets a contribution of 1/r, and you have to balance it against some brain contribution, brain mass terms. And no matter what are the corrections to these brain masses, they can be small, but you have to somehow tune already at the true level.
When you were writing these guesses for the Mohr factor, which you needed to get interesting results out of there, you had some in this conformally flat formula, right? You have some pure exponential, yes? And if you were to go to some form where the radial coordinate is normalized to unity, then this would look like a power law, yes? Like a scale factor multiplying the...
if you go to this coordinate, then there's of course the fifth dimension is not infinite, yeah?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So then that sounds like you're basically ending the space on a curvature singularity in the bulk at some finite distance.
Yes.
Right?
That's what it is. Yeah, that's the naked singularity, curvature singularity in the finite invariant distance.
Right, right.
That's
so I suppose that's not that hard to get from the point of view of writing some theories in the bulk to give you those solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And we just put massless scalar fields or something like
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But then I guess you go into the issue of discussing how to deal with the singularity. And if I remember correctly, there was the rule of thumb was, okay, there are two ways to deal with it. One is imposing boundary conditions, simply ignoring this, you know, accept the background, choose the boundary conditions, which are like Neumann boundary conditions for fluctuations on the singularity that decouple things nicely, and that's a kind of meaningful way to do it from the law energy theory point of view. But at some level you might say, well, you know, that this is really fine-tuning the singularity, it's much worse than that in a full dynamical theory and so on and so forth, which of course is this other attitude, simply saying, oh, you know, you really need to resolve this, putting in some object in there, and then that requires some... But which one do you think...
I'm thinking about this other way, yeah? So we are thinking about the string theory completions to that, there are some ideas, but very vague at this point, about NS5 brains, yeah? The point is, the funny thing is that if you can get these solutions from the Dilaton gravity system, so that's easy. However, that was the metric in the Einstein frame. If you go to the string frame, the metric becomes flat with linear Dilaton.
Uh-huh.
These things are kind of known in string theory, but also they are very hard, yeah? So
these are these little strings or something, right? But
So that's
difficult.
This is the pit, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's the thing we're trying to think of. But at this level, I cannot tell you much more than that because I just don't know. Not that I don't want to tell you. But
so coming back to this hierarchy problem, you're saying that effectively that mu does not get any loop corrections. Is that right?
No,
because you can certainly say that you can take M UH large, but then the question would be whether mu would have quadratic.
So mu is a property of the background, yeah? Now.
Right, so it'd be a back reaction or something like that.
So
right?
The question is, what are the loop corrections to the gravitational background? And I said, I don't know, but you know, from this point of view, the standard model is not viable, yeah? Because you get a loop correction to the cosmological constant that destabilizes the standard model. So, I don't know the situation. Yeah? Again, if you go to some string theory model, you can address this question. At this level, I think it's not possible to address.
So you have no idea whether it would depend upon would increase if you took away, if your string theory would cut off at some very high scale versus some very
I would expect that there shouldn't be, because you know this kind of things in a dual picture, yeah, that's mass gap corresponds to some probably some condensation scale in a strongly coupled theory, which you know that in QCD the gap between lambda QCD and the Planck scale is not a problem, yeah? So I think at the end of the day this is not the worst problem.
Let's thank Adam again.